Okay, welcome back. Our first guest this evening is Jim Mosquera. Jim presents a unique profile with 2 degrees in industrial engineering and a business background in telecommunications and networking, and a self-developed knowledge of economics and the financial markets. He's a principal at Sentinel Consulting, a small business debt restructuring and capital acquisition firm. Jim is the author of the Chandler Scott novels, 2020 and Rebellion, and the nonfiction series Escaping Oz. He is a frequent contributor to many online financial journals. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you. I guess I'd like to start out by asking you to give us a little background about yourself.
Well, I'm originally from Panama City, Panama, emigrated to the United States as a young child, and grew up primarily in St. Louis, Missouri, and Panama City, Panama. As you mentioned in the introduction, I do have a couple of degrees in industrial engineering. Ironically, I didn't really get a chance to apply any of that industrial engineering knowledge in my professional career because I went into telecommunications and networking and had a number of jobs in that field. Throughout the course of my professional career in telecommunications and networking, I was always very curious about the financial markets. So I traded commodities. You know, many years ago, I started a newsletter about the economy and the financial markets. It led to the development of my first book on the Escaping Oz series, which happened in 2010, early 2011. I followed up in 2015 with a successor to that book, also in the Escaping Oz series. And within the last year or so, as you mentioned, I've developed a couple of novels that really I was kind of hoping to tell a story about kind of the way I see things anyway, potentially going, and it's a potential path for the economy and the country in 2020 and Rebellion. I'm working on the third and last of that series right now, which will hopefully just kind of wrap, you know, the whole story up about Chandler Scott and the United States.
So what got you started in writing as an author, and especially in fiction books?
Well, I was always a very strong communicator orally and written. You know, in my professional career, I was generally in front of a lot of people, say customers, you know, in selling, making presentations, whether that's, you know, internally or externally, did a lot of writing of reports. So, I mean, I always knew I could write. So I think it was way back in about 2008, 2009, and I thought, you know, why don't I start this process of being a contributor in the financial market? So I contributed to several online outlets, and I started my own newsletter. And I always just have had just a very strong appreciation for money. I guess that's the best way to describe it. And obviously money is integral to any economy, so I guess that kind of fostered, you know, that enjoyment of doing that. As far as the fictional part of it, somebody told me something, I guess, a couple of years ago. They said, you know, Jim, people want to they want a story. They want to be entertained. Well, my Escaping Oz series of books, those are nonfiction. I mean, I can't really describe those as entertainment. They're nonfiction, so it's fact. Very, very important knowledge that I think is crucial for people to have, not just in understanding the economy, but really, I mean, I saw it front and center this year, about understanding about politics and what's really going on and what the candidates are really saying and how that might help things or not help things. And so when somebody told me, you know, Jim, people want a story, I thought, well, how could I take what I've written about in Escaping Oz and kind of project it forward, not too far into the future, because the book 2020, as the title implies, starts in the year 2020. And so it's not that far in the future where it's science fiction, but it's something that when you read 2020, you think, and I've had some people tell me this, yeah, Jim, I could see something like that potentially happening. And while it's entertaining, it's also disturbing at the same time.
Okay. Now, your nonfiction book, Escaping Oz, what's the short summary about this book's subject matter?
It's really a lot about money, debt, the economy, what some of the factors are that affect the economy. And as I was speaking to somebody the other day, a group that I met with, the landmines that are still out there, that, again, irrespective of who was going to be elected president, they're still there. And so it's important to understand how government, if you will, how business is going to handle these landmines. And I still think that, that's something that's still lacking in the, I guess, in the knowledge base of most Americans, is to really understand the basis or the root cause of a lot of these problems. And it's very, very easy for politicians to stake claims about how these landmines, I guess, are going to be defused, if you want to use a military term, and how we're going to be able to go around them. And I have an opposing view to that, but it's difficult to get that message out, because, you know, most of the time with government, there's a lot of what they call bread and circuses, and I think people get caught up in that, and then they don't see, I guess, the reality of what's really there.
So why is it important for people to read this book?
Well, I think, you know, I have put a chapter, Freebird, in the Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis book, towards the end of the book, and I called it What Should Government Be? And it's a very simple question, but it's something that I think we still continue to struggle with. You know, we've had 8 years of a Democratic administration where obviously some people were very elated, you know, with some of the progress that was made, and other people are very much in opposition. And why is there such discord there? Well, it really all comes down to economics. And, you know, when you don't know what you really want government to be, I think you end up with all this gray area, and you don't really have, let's say, to use a term maybe from mechanics or automotive, you don't have a governor, if you will, with what the government can do fiscally, because we're talking today about $20 trillion with a T in debt, and that's what's called funded debt. That's not even the unfunded liabilities that exist. And, I mean, if we had had that discussion 20 years ago, we would have just been completely appalled, but now it just seems very commonplace that we can discuss debt in multiples of trillions. And that's the part that's very, very concerning to me, and I just don't think people understand the gravity of what lies before them.
So what would you say for people out there is the greatest problem facing our economy now?
It's a four-letter word. It begins with the letter D as in dog, and EBT, debt. As I mentioned on the on the government side, you've got, again, funded $20 trillion in debt. The Congressional Budget Office, if I read something correctly the other day, that I think throughout the course of the next 10 years, they're projecting that debt to grow by about 50%. So, in other words, in 10 years from now, that funded debt would be $30 trillion. And, again, that's making a lot of potentially rosy assumptions. That's before any, if this even happens, infrastructure spending occurs. It also doesn't necessarily consider what I'll call a normalization of long-term interest rates, which I think you're starting to see the first signs of that changing. So that's a huge problem. And, again, that's the funded part, the things that are identified. When people hear the term unfunded liabilities, which, of course, relate to Social Security and Medicare, you know, some people would argue, well, Jim, that's not a debt that we owe right now, and that's true. But when you're planning, let's say, if you were planning for your retirement, and let's say that Social Security didn't exist, and you were 40 years old and you wanted to retire at age 65, well, you think, well, that's 25 years from now. Do I have the money to retire at age 65? Okay, no, I don't. So I need to start planning for that, right? So part of that is allocating a certain portion of your disposable income towards savings, so you build for that point when you retire in 25 years. That's a huge landmine that exists, for the United States of America right now, because there's different forecasts of when, you know, Social Security Trust Fund and the Medicare Trust Fund essentially become bankrupt, and that's actual real cash. These unfunded liabilities have to do with projections for the future of how much money is going to be required to satisfy health care expenses and pensions for the old age. So that's really the big problem that exists right now.
So how is the book Escaping Oz actually structured?
I start out with what I call the fundamentals. So whenever you're trying to figure out a problem, and so I say this from an engineering background, you know, so what's the fundamental cause of a problem? So I go back and I give some very basic examples of, you know, if you didn't have money, you know, how would you have to go about, you know, transacting commerce? And I progress from there, and I show different examples of what constituted money in the New World, you know, throughout the course of America's history. And you can see how the definition itself of what money became over the course of time. And there are some very, very significant events that I cite in the book that occurred that altered not just the definition of money, but the public's perception of what money really is. And because that occurred, it gives policymakers the ability to be, I guess, let's say, fiscally irresponsible. And it's very, very easy to be fiscally irresponsible when the definition of money has been altered so greatly and violently, really. So, I take people through that process of money. I talk about cycles. You know, time and life, if you will, is not just a straight line. You know, things occur in cycles. We understand tides. You know, we understand a woman's gestational period. And so there are some cycles that can be identified with respect to, you know, economics, stock market cycles, and so forth, business growth. And so I talk about that. I talk about the financial crisis of 2008, you know, what happened, what some of the causes were, how some of those things still haven't been resolved. I dedicate a chapter to the Federal Reserve, who are part of the Escaping Oz, by the way. It kind of lightly touches on the Wizard of Oz theme. So I identify who these wizards are and why we place so much trust in them. And if people remember the story of the movie The Wizard of Oz, you know, one of the seminal point in the whole movie was when, you know, when Toto ran away from Dorothy and pulled back the curtain. And what you saw was this very ordinary-looking man who was, you know, pushing buttons and pulling levers. And so that's kind of what the book tries to do, is it tries to demystify all of these things that people are used to seeing from the wizards being in central banking and government, and to really try and understand, you know, what's really going on. And then I conclude the book with what I call, you know, kind of some recommendations for the future of, you know, how societies really need to organize, probably in a smaller level, because it will be more challenging for people to rely on, again, these wizards, the federal government, central bankers, et cetera, for their livelihood.
So what is the most important thing about a market?
Two things. And this gets Freebird into that whole concept of that chapter where I talked about what should government be. So the two things that are really important for a market are, if outside of barter, so if we assume that we've got something to use instead of bartering, you know, we have a good sound monetary unit, you know, currency that everybody trusts, can't be easily manipulated. And then the other part of it, other two parts of it are laws. So you have civil laws, which means that people agreed, or people do what they say they agreed to do. So if you agree to sell me something and I buy it from you and then you decide that you're not going to deliver it to me, well, then I have the ability to seek compensation for that. And we do today, obviously, through the civil courts of law. So the other aspect of it is civil law. The other is I want to be safe in the market, that I can sell my wares and I don't have to worry about people plundering what I have, stealing it, causing other sorts of mayhem. So that's criminal law. So if we have some sort of a money unit, we have civil law, and we have criminal law, that's really those what I call the bare essentials of what you need to have a functioning market.
I guess a lot of people would ask, you know, is the economic crisis over, or are we still in the middle of it?
And you know, the recession, as defined by the Bureau of Economic Statistics, you know, they I think it was around June of 2009 where they declared the recession officially over. The stock market made its low in March of 2009. So roughly 3 months after the stock market made its low, the government declared the recession was officially over. Now, if you look at things like GDP, you know, gross domestic product, you know, the unemployment ranks and so forth, has there been improvement in those statistics? Yes, there has. The other aspect of it is to look at, well, what did the Wizards have to do in order to make that happen? Well, I mentioned earlier what happened with the federal government's debt. One thing that people may or may not be aware of is that the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, went out into the market and bought up a bunch of things that if had they not bought those things might have, you know, crashed in value. So if you will, that there's been a papering over of some of the effects of the 2008 financial crisis. Now, in the book Escaping Oz, one of the things I show is I show these cones, and I say that when there's all this excess liquidity, which is basically what the Fed does, the Fed goes and buys something, well, the person that they bought that from now all of a sudden has cash available to them to do something else with it. And whether people know this or not, the Federal Reserve doesn't have this stash of gold or cash that they're using to buy all these things up with. They're synthetically buying them up by creating, you know, electronic entry. So when all this extra cash floating around in the system, you know, in their minds, well, the cash is going to be reinvested and it's going to help Main Street and so forth. Well, the reality is it tends to fuel bubbles. And it tends to fuel bubbles in the areas of the credit markets, like bonds, and then it also tends to fuel bubbles in the area of the stock market. And clearly, since 2009, we have seen a very, very much a Fed-fueled, wizard-fueled bubble in both stocks and bonds and other assets as well. I mean, you've seen what I consider a pretty significant reflation of the real estate market. So that's what happens when you have all this excess liquidity. It tries to go somewhere. So in the book, I illustrate these cones that it just kind of tends to funnel to and attack, if you will, certain investments.
Now, earlier you mentioned landmines. What landmines are there out there that this economy might hit?
Well, I would say we talked about the debt earlier. So the fiscal situation in the United States, obviously, I don't know that maybe 10, 20 years ago. I remember when they were talking the other day about when Reagan took office, the debt went from, I think it was like 30% of our gross domestic product, and then when he left 8 years later, it was like 50%, and that seemed like an incredible thing. Well, our debt now is like 100, and again, this is the funded debt, is about 105% of what the country produces, you know, GDP in a year. So that's certainly a huge landmine. The unfunded liabilities that we talked about earlier, that's not a landmine that maybe you're going to hit in the next couple of years, but it's definitely there. I think there's some other what I'll call social landmines that I think we definitely saw manifested in this election. I talked about that actually in my first Escaping Oz book, that I said that when I saw the Tea Party and then I saw the Occupy movement, that there was this very, very strong undercurrent. Again, this is way back then in 2009, 2010, where I saw something happening at that point, and you know that strong undercurrent was not going to go away regardless of what the government was saying or unemployment rate was and so forth, because you could see that, again, what I talked about earlier, those funnels where all that excess liquidity goes, you know, things on Wall Street look great, things on Main Street, you know, not as great. And U.S. corporations, there's always discussion, well, you know, they have all this cash. They've also incurred a significant amount of debt because, why, interest rates were low. So you have these very artificially low interest rates. So companies borrow a lot of money, and then instead of reinvesting that money, if you will, in capital infrastructure, maybe even in human capital, a lot of it's gone into what? Paying dividends and repurchasing stock. So that doesn't bode well for the next leg, if you will, of productive capacity of a lot of these U.S. corporations. Because you've had these ridiculously low interest rates, there are people like my mother who is on a fixed income that basically wakes up at night in cold sweats because she says, Jim, you know, what am I going to do? I've I've got the money in the bank, but it's hardly paying anything. And, you know, that's not an easy answer to give, you know, and it's something that on a personal level, I've struggled a lot in helping her with that, because the alternative to that, which is what's happening, creates debt bubbles or credit bubbles, is that then people then try to flow into riskier investments. And for somebody of her age, who's in her mid to late 70s, it becomes a much more difficult proposition to say, okay, Mom, you know, I think you need to get into this. And the risk factor associated with that is very high. If interest rates, let's say for a one-year CD, were at 5% instead of maybe 0.5%, we wouldn't be having that conversation. So the other landmine, Freebird, is the way that savings in this country have just been absolutely decimated by these abnormally artificially low interest rates.
You have a series of books coming out in the fictional genre. One is called 2020, and it's the first book of what's called the Chandler Scott series. Can you tell us a little bit about that in detail?
Yeah, so taking, if you will, just take the reality of what I talked about in the Escaping Oz book. So, you know, we're in the year 2016 right now, almost 2017. So 2020 starts, the book starts in the year 2019. And the backdrop of the book, I talk about some of the things that, you know, again, could, because I'm just fictional now, could happen financially, socially. And it sets the backdrop for this fictional character, Chandler Scott, who's a TV journalist, and he covers these events around, he's a financial journalist, so he covers financial events and political events, too, around the world. And he sees these things beginning to happen within his own country, and, yeah, there's some financial panics that occur. But then there's also another aspect that's already affecting American life, and I develop it more in the novel 2020, which is cyber attacks, cyber hacks, even ranging into cyber warfare as the novel series progresses. And so you have the combination of financial distress that affects everyone. You have cyber terror, if you will. And now you see it more on a domestic level. So not so much, okay, well, it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda that's attacking the United States. You know, these are some things that are occurring from within. And now you're coming up to the presidential election of 2020. So because of that, it makes the election of 2020 very, very interesting, and it makes it more interesting because in the novel there are two political parties that are running for office along with the GOP and the Democrats. And different than what you saw this year where, you know, you had, you know, the Green Party with Jill Stein, you know, there's a Constitution Party, and then there was another gentleman by the name of Evan McMullen that ran in Utah. These are parties that actually had established themselves, again, fictionally, in the 2018 and even the 2016 presidential election in the book. So by the time it gets to 2020, these political parties have some traction where they have, you know, members in Congress and state legislatures and so forth. And part of the reason I did it that way is because, again, what I saw this year in the 2016 election was very, very indicative of what I had predicted probably 5 or 6 years ago, which is that there would be this strong undercurrent that would, if you will, push back against the established GOP and Democratic base. And there was no better representation of that, in my mind, than on the Republican side. There were two candidates that fit that bill. One is the current president-elect, and the other one was Dr. Ben Carson. And neither one of these gentlemen really fit into the traditional Republican mold. And matter of fact, you could argue that the current president-elect probably doesn't even really have a strong political ideology. On the Democratic side, the person that really exemplified that was Bernie Sanders, who gave, obviously, Hillary, you know, everything that she could handle. But Bernie Sanders, if you know, is actually an independent candidate and described himself as a, quote, democratic socialist, unquote. So, I mean, I saw in this election kind of what I laid out in 2020, that you really had GOP, you had Democrat, you had what I'll call an opposition candidate on the Republican side who's now our president-elect, and then you had a very, very strong campaign run by Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side who, I'll make a prediction here on this show, is that in the next 4 years, the term that you're going to hear a lot is progressive. And that's going to be the rallying cry for the Democratic Party. Now, whether it stays exactly like it is, I'm not making that prediction, but that's something that you're going to hear about. So in 2020, I took that strong undercurrent that I see, I mean, we saw it very clearly this year, and projected that into other political parties, again, two other political parties that will run in, again, for the presidency in 2020. So 2020, the novel ends roughly around the time of the 2020 election with some very explosive things that occur there.
Could you can you explain the difference between cyber terror and kinetic terror?
Yeah, so cyber terror is like what you would see. I guess we're talking about it quite a bit now in the news, where there's been accusations made about hacks to the DNC and now even potentially the RNC emails and so forth. So that's the cyber part, you know, things that have to do with computers, computer networks, things in cyberspace. Kinetic terror would be like the Oklahoma City bombing that occurred in the Murrah building back in the 90s, where there's something that physically happens. And one of the things that will be themes, I guess, in throughout the Chandler Scott series is less of things that, let's just say, blow up, so, you know, kinetic terror, and more in the realm of cyber, because I'm starting to see more and more of that now. In the book, I take it to some completely different directions that people will probably think, wow, can that really happen? And in reality, some of these things that I talk about in the book are possible today, and some are, let's say, projections or predictions on my part about how I think cyber terror will be used in the future.
In your book, it mentions the collision of economics and politics. What is the real possibility of that?
Well, that's really what 2020 is about. Probably, let's say, half the theme of the book is again, you have an economy that's teetering, and again, one thing I'll say about 2020 and the book that follows it, Rebellion, they're both very, very realistic. There's research that was done on my part, again, to make it realistic. There's also knowledge that I had to try to make it realistic. But politics and economics colliding basically means that, you know, if you have an economy and in a financial system that's teetering, the political part of that will be how government reacts to that. And the other side of that is the public. How will the public react to that? And will the public retreat, or will they ask government to do more? And that's some of the tension, if you will, that you'll find in the book 2020, which is, you know, you'll have some people that will say, government, you have to come in and you have to help because we're suffering. And we're not only are we suffering economically, but we're suffering at the hands of cyber terrorists. I mean, this is the United States, for God's sake. You need to help us. And then there's others that say, no, the government has grown too authoritative, and they're really starting to impinge upon our personal freedoms, our financial freedoms. And so because of what occurs in 2020 and some of the things that occur politically, it leads to the reaction to all that in the second book in the series, which is called Rebellion, which is actually a Latin for rebellion. And it shows how different groups in the country will react. And it won't necessarily be, again, don't think necessarily of things exploding or war in the conventional sense, but you'll see a lot more opposition from groups that, again, have taken opposition to the extension of the government's authority, not just in terms of civil liberties, but in terms of financial repression, if you will, as well.
So is that part of the consequences of such collision?
That's exactly right, yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, if you just look back through history, you know, when have societies reacted? I mean, you know, maybe as a consequence of losing a war, maybe as a consequence of winning a war. The other aspect of it is, you think about some of the things that have occurred of significance in societies when there's been some sort of an economic calamity or financial calamity. So oftentimes these sort of, revolutionary changes occur because of some extraordinary event. And if you think about it also, my thought on it is that a lot of these things, they if you look at it from afar, it looks like they're occurring in slow motion, and they do take a long time to develop. So these things happen, you know, very slowly, but then they happen very suddenly, you know, when the key event occurs. So that's what you'll see in 2020, and then the reaction to what happens politically you'll see in the next novel, Rebellion, which, again, shows how different parts of society will react to what the politics was.
And we mentioned terrorism earlier, but how can terrorism affect financial matters?
Well, in 2020, there are, again, some financial events that occur, and without giving away too much, at times there are, let's say, cyber terror events that would affect. So as an example, let's say tomorrow, you know, the New York Stock Exchange opened, and about 20 minutes in, everything shut down. And let's say it shut down because, you know, somebody hacked into the trading computers of the New York Stock Exchange, and then there was a hack in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the New York Mercantile Exchange. So all of a sudden, you know, that what does that do? It introduces a doubt or a lack of confidence in the financial system. And the worst thing that could happen in any financial system is that lack of doubt, or excuse me, that doubt and that lack of confidence, because that then instills panic. And panic is the last thing you want to have, because when there's a panic, and just think of being in a crowded theater when somebody yells fire, everybody rushes to the exit. Well, everybody, imagine also that theater has, you know, 1,000 people in it and only one exit, so everybody can't get out at once. That's a definition of a panic.
Now, you mentioned having more than one or two strong parties, political parties, earlier. How do you think Americans are going to react if they have more than two strong political parties?
Well, you know, part of that, I will just admit to your listeners that when they read 2020, there's a personal bias there about the existence of other political parties. And part of that is because I think the country needs it. There needs to be some other voices that were heard, that are heard. If this year's election didn't create that clarity for you, you know, maybe the next one will, because, you know, we had two candidates that were running this year that, you know, evoke such strong hatred on, you know, on the opposite side. And even the people that were voting for that candidate, their candidate, you know, they didn't feel very strongly about him. And that's not a situation that, again, as you move into times where, you know, stronger leadership is going to be required because, again, of these landmines that I mentioned earlier, you know, you want to have somebody that the country can rally around. And, I mean, I was under no illusion that, you know, if the Democratic contender had won, that there would be many people in the country that would have viewed her as illegitimate. And just as you see now, you have people that view the president-elect as illegitimate. I think if you have other choices that are there, I just think it would probably bring at least the two main parties, the GOP and the Democrats, would probably maybe sharpen them up a little bit. Because I was very disappointed this year that, you know, in the course of the three debates that were held, the way the media covered, there was really very little of substance that was talked about, and that's disappointing from a voter standpoint. Moving forward, you know, the economy hits a few more landmines. You know, I don't think people are going to be as concerned about some of the things that were talked about in this year's election. And so that's why, again, my personal bias is I'd like to see other strong choices available to run for president and other local and state offices as well.
Now, your novel 2020, it has politics as one of its thriller components. What parallels can you draw from the recent 2016 election and the storyline of 2020?
You know, to be determined there, to be honest with you, Freebird, because as I mentioned earlier, if you consider Trump and Dr. Carson non-Republicans that ran as Republicans, and likewise with Sanders, you know, somebody that was an independent Democratic socialist and ran as a Democrat, I don't know exactly what's going to happen with the Democratic Party. Will the what I'll call the progressive wing, which again that word I mentioned earlier, is that going to manifest in now the, you know, maybe the reported DNC chair, Mr. Ellison from Minnesota, who again labels him, he's strongly aligned with Sanders. Is that the way the Democratic Party is going to go, or would those guys potentially spin off in the next election? Likewise, on the GOP side, you know, you had a president-elect that was elected with virtually no, what I consider, core Republican support. Now, obviously, he's their president, so it kind of remains to be seen. So I still think there are elements that are there that for 2020 you could see something beyond just the GOP and a Democratic challenger for the highest office. And again, serious contenders for that. And when I say serious, I mean to the extent of what Ross Perot did in 1992. But whereas Ross Perot got about 19% of the vote, you know, my view would be, and I guess you'd have to go back maybe to George Wallace in 68, where somebody actually won a state that was not a GOP or a Democrat. That's something that I could definitely foresee happening in 2020.
So what topics are covered in your book, Rebellion? That's the second book in the series, right?
Yeah, so Rebellion basically picks up where 2020 left off. So 2020 ends right at the end of the year 2020. And so because of what happens, again, without giving away the plot of 2020, some things happen there. There's a strong reaction on the part of some groups. I think, Freebird, you and I talked about this in Rebellion, and this is before I had ever met you or even encountered the Watchmen. I created a group called the Honor Brigade that, after, you know, you and I had that conversation, and it turns out that there's some parallels between the Honor Brigade and the Watchmen, just by coincidence.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, and actually it's good because it actually, you know, will help me for the next novel that I'm writing right now, and I'm hoping to meet with Grizz in Colorado here, hopefully in about 2 or 3 weeks, and to get kind of some more information. But, you know, what's the reaction to all that? You know, there's a financial reaction, there's a social reaction, and then you'll see, let's say, more play from what I'll call these cyber groups, these secession groups that are within the country that, you know, they feel that government's gone too far now. And there's a little bit more emphasis on technology in the second book. Somebody approached me today, and they were telling me about the review of the first book, and they said, you know, Jim, we really liked the first book a lot, but it was – you had a lot of information in the first novel. I said, yeah, I did that on purpose because part of what I wanted to do in 2020 was to kind of educate at the same time I was telling a story. When you get to Rebellion, it's less of that educational stuff, if you will. It becomes a faster-moving story from the very, very beginning. There's another character that gets brought in that works with Chandler. So there's a little bit more mystery, if you will. There's, you know, a lot more tension. So, again, just consider, again, Rebellion is a reaction to what happened in 2020.
So what's next for the Chandler Scott series, and when can people expect to read more?
Well, right now I'm working on the third novel in the series. I don't have a name for it yet. You know, if any reader has any suggestions, I'd be happy to take them up on that. That's probably one of the toughest things, at least for me, is to come up with the title of a book. But the next one will deal with a couple of interesting topics. I think you and I had a discussion when you and I spoke the first time that in the second book, Rebellion, I mentioned something called Convention of the States, which is a real thing where the states can get together, hold a, you know, a constitutional convention to talk about making some changes to the Constitution. And there's a process that gets followed there. And again, I actually mentioned that in the second book about something that would happen. And so that gets developed a little bit more in the next book. There's also probably a little bit more discussion on with the Honor Brigade. There's going to be a little bit more discussion on what I'll call a cyber secession group, which gets a little bit more into technology, and maybe a little bit more exploration about, you know, just some other secession groups that are currently in play in the United States right now. I don't use any real names or even the names of organizations, but I try to parallel it, if you will, and kind of project a little bit in the future. The president will be a little bit more involved in this, and there's probably going to be a resolution, if you will, to this at the end. I'm not going to tell you what the resolution is going to be. And depending on, you know, how these series of three books are concerned, I'm going to leave it in such a way to where there could be more books after the third book based on, you know, how I'm going to end it.
We've got,
and I guess I'll probably mention, The third book in the series will be out in 2017 for sure.
That's good. That's good. If you don't mind, Jim, we've got a few questions from some of our listeners that are posting in. You mind answering some of those?
Yes, sir. Let's do it.
The first one says that Trump's list is to penalize corporations that take manufacturing offshore and to charge them a 35% tariff to import them back to the U.S. Does that equal collapse?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that question again?
Okay. It says Trump's list is to penalize corporations that take manufacturing offshore and to charge them a 35% tariff to import them back into the U.S. Does that equal collapse?
It may not equal collapse, but if people remember some of their economic history, when we had the Great Depression after the stock market crash of 1929 and in the 30s, there was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, and the world, if you will, kind of got into a large-scale economic war. And if you think about when I've talked about earlier about, you know, having that market. So if one thing is to define a market in a really kind of a small way, like I did it simplistically, but the other aspect of it is, okay, we can't do that. We've got world markets. And if you start, you know, stifling trade by the imposition of tariffs, what are other countries are going to do? They're going to retaliate. And we have a problem already that, where you have, I'll just use the term currency war. I don't know if I mentioned that in my book or not, you know, but a currency war exists when countries are continually manipulating exchange rates. And in 1971, just a real quick brief history aside here, Richard Nixon did something that I thought was far more momentous than what happened in Watergate, and that's, you know, he took the United States away from what's called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which at one point in time, you know, foreign countries could exchange dollars for gold. Well, when he closed that window, at that point, all currencies then shortly thereafter began to what's called float against one another. And that's a problem that exists today. You know, a president like Trump talked a lot about, you know, China manipulating the currency to gain advantage for their products, for their exports. That's true, but guess what? All countries manipulate their currencies, and they even do it in a coordinated fashion between the central bank wizards. So, you start overlaying more things like tariffs or, you know, get into even bigger scale currency wars, that's not helpful for world economies.
Okay, another question is, what does the interest rate hike mean that happened just today?
That interest rate move, which was, again, the discount rate that the Fed controls, which, by the way, that's the only interest rate that they actually control directly. Honestly, that was something that I saw coming. I think a lot of other financial pundits saw it coming as well. A lot of times people think that the Fed, again, back to the wizard narrative, that they're in control. But if you look at what's been happening with interest rates, both on the short term and certainly on the long term rates, you know, 10-year and 30-year rates, interest rates have already been rising, I believe, probably since mid to late summer, just very, very slowly. They've accelerated lately. So, people think a lot of times that the Fed is ahead of things. A lot of times the Fed actually responds to what's going on already in the market. The market is much bigger than the Fed, much more powerful than the Fed, and really has ultimate control. So what happened today, really kind of a non-event for me. I knew it was going to happen. It's going to be the first of a series of moves by them. The argument is, well, their academic argument, the Fed's argument was, they need to have something in play to where when the next recession hits that they can then cut interest rates again, because right now we were at about 0.25% to 0.5%. Well, you can't cut much more than that unless you go negative, and, you know, that's a whole other topic, negative interest rates. So some academic theory says, well, they had to raise rates because when we get the next recession, which should be very soon, they need to have some room to come back down again. That's basically essentially acknowledging that the Fed is out of dry powder.
You see a 30-year mortgage rate shift?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's already happened. And if you look at a chart of, you know, 10 and 30-year Treasury bond rates, which, again, mortgage rates are tied to those, I believe the low in interest rates probably occurred, I'd have to look at a chart, probably sometime in July or August. So that trend's already there.
Another question is, the SWIFT banking system was hacked. Do you see future implications from that?
Yeah, and if I think it was about a month or two ago, the Central Bank of Bangladesh was hacked to the tune of, I mean, millions of dollars. And it's funny that the listener asked that question, because those are some of the topics that get explored in my fiction book, 2020, and then Rebellion as well. Is, you know, here's something that I'd like to kind of point out to your listeners. We're talking about hacking SWIFT. One of the things that I want people to be very, very conscious of is, if you hear a lot of discussion about something called the war on cash, there's academics right now that are advocating that the United States get rid of the $100 bill. And in India, they did something very recently where they wanted to exchange, like, old currency for new currency. And again, most of the time what you're going to hear on that is that there's a relationship there to terrorism and illegal drug trafficking because with the use of cash. I won't dispute that. But one of the things that I did talk about in Escaping Oz is that it's very, very important for people to keep cash on hand if for any reason that – let's say that there is a hack, just like somebody just mentioned with SWIFT. Let's say that your bank got hacked, or that, you know, the financial system of the United States got hacked. And during the time, and I was in technology, that you need to sort this out. Well, how long is that going to be? A week, 10 days, 2 weeks? Would there be a declaration of a banking holiday by the president? Obviously, that's already happened in our past, so that's nothing new. Banking holidays have occurred in countries besides the United States for, I mean, weeks at a time. So it wouldn't be unprecedented. So imagine now that you don't have cash and you've got plastic only, and then you go try to buy something. Well, I mean, obviously that becomes a much, much tougher proposition. And if something like that were to happen, the value of cash, and I mean, you know, greenbacks, moolah dough, goes up significantly. So that's a real strong reason to have cash. And the other strong reason is, not even so much from a hacking standpoint, but, you know, when people's, you know, financial interests get compromised, you know, with identity theft, right? I mean, that's happened before. I've known people that have had, you know, identity, their credit score goes to hell. Obviously, they can't do a lot of things. But, you know, if you have cash, you always have some purchasing power. Now, other people would say, extend that. Well, there needs to be some gold. Gold is money as well. But, I mean, that's another long discussion. So, very, very important for people to stay very, very close to this and speak to their elected representatives. If there's ever a strong move to say, you know what, we need to get rid of cash because of this, that's when you need to call your elected representatives and say, wait a second, you know, here's maybe some reasons why you shouldn't do that.
Okay. Folks, you can get information on Jim's written works at www.jimmosquera, that's MOSQUERA.com. That's his website. And you can read reviews about all of his books over there. Jim, we look forward to your additional books, and we certainly were honored to have you join us this evening on our show. Thank you
for
coming.
It's been great for me to be on, and be happy to be a guest on your show in the future.
Absolutely. We look forward to it. All right. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and good night.
All right. Good night.